Hi there, thanks for tuning in. We were joined by best-selling non-fiction writer and journalist Peter Fitzsimons to talk about his latest book, The Legend of Albert Jekka. This book tells the extraordinary story of a shy farm boy who became Australia's first World War I Victoria Cross recipient. This event was recorded in front of a live audience in the Henry Carmichael Theatre at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts, which is located on Gadigal land.
Thank you for turning up at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts Library, people. I'll faithfully report this event in the Herald that there were 400 squeezed into a small theatre. So after that kind introduction, I think if I can address what I suspect is the mood in the room of he doesn't look like an author, he looks like a thug. And if you are thinking that, you're not the first to have so thought. About 35 years ago, about half a kilometre that away, I was invited to the highly prestigious opening of the Rembrandt exhibition at the New South Wales Art Gallery, only invited because my sister-in-law was the curator who'd brought it from Holland, and before attending she'd given me strict instruction how to wear the black tie properly, how to hold the champagne glass by the stem, and we don't guzzle and throw it down our throat. We sip and we converse and we move on. And I was desperately trying to fit in with the glitterati of the Sydney arts world, couldn't help but notice the Executive Director General of the New South Wales Art Gallery, Edmund Capon, kept sneaking glances at me. What kind of a Neanderthal is this who has wandered into the New South Wales Art Gallery by mistake? I managed to work into the conversation. Actually, I have just finished my first book. And he immediately brightened up, congratulated me, and encouraged me to read another one. So I feel very blessed somehow to have wandered into the book trade, being an author. I absolutely love it. I've got three beautiful children, and what I most wish for them is the stroke of good fortune that sort of sent me down the path of writing books. I couldn't say exactly when I was first published in the Sydney Morning Herald, but I think it was the 30th of May, 1986. And for me, that was put the glasses down. This is what I want to do forevermore. And the first serious, the second book, I did a collection of sort of travel stories. My second book was another collection called Hitchhiking for Ugly People, which is the only clever title I've come up with. But the first serious biography book I did was of my best friend Nick Farr-Jones. And that was perfect place to start because I had cultural literacy in rugby and the Wallabies. He and I had been named in the Wallabies together for the first time. He went on to great, glorious captain of the Wallaby World Cup winning team. And at least writing about him, I knew what a ruck was, I knew what a maul was. Sadly, I knew who Alan Jones was. But it was a great place to start, and that sort of sent me down the path of doing a lot of sports books. And then in 96, if I can give you a very quick potted history, I was in the cafeteria of the cafeteria queue at HarperCollins putting to bed a sports book. And the publisher said to me, "So what's your next book?" And I thought to myself instantly, you know how your mind can sometimes go in slow-mo and you have these rapid thoughts even though the whole thing only takes 3 seconds. I thought, oh, serious authors must have a next book. And I said, well, I think I might write away to the new opposition leader, Kim Beazley, to see if I can write his biography. And at that moment, had he sneered, had he snarled, had he sniggered, the whole thing would have been dead. Instead, he said, well, that's a good idea. Why don't you do that? And so I did. Never truly expecting a reply. To my amazement, 3 weeks later, an answer came directed in a writing unexpected. And I think the same was written with a thumbnail dipped in tar. And it said, come down and have a chat to Kim. I did. He said yes. I flew back to Sydney and what I thought was absolute triumph, sent an email to my editor-in-chief saying, I've just agreed to write Kim Beazley's biography. I might be needing some time off. He sent me back an email saying, well done. I'm sure you'll do yourself and the Herald proud. I think you should know, however, that Beazley is spelt with a Z. And so began the two most dreadful years of my life, staring at the cracks in the ceiling night after night, thinking, God help me, whatever made me think I could write a political biography. And I always went back to a story the Herald had sent me on in 93 to accompany the late, great Gough Whitlam on a 5-day sojourn to Perth. I've never forgotten that trip for going through the Ansett Air Terminal at Sydney Airport, as it then was, Mr. Whitlam leading the way, me with a carry-on luggage behind, both his and mine. And as we went through the metal detectors, Mr. Whitlam must have still had his house keys or his car keys in his pocket, because sure enough, there was a sudden like that, and the little guys came in to hover all over him with those metal wand detectors. And Mr. Whitlam, without breaking his stride, turned to them and said, "I think you'll find it's my aura." And I think he was right. And so that book, I've never had... They used to talk about nervous breakdowns. I think they're now sort of emotional trauma or something. I've never had a nervous breakdown, but on that one I was close because I was just so exhausted. But 18 months later, I got a phone call out of the blue. "My name's Jim Cowley. I'm a pharmacist up Port Macquarie way. Mate, I'm looking after Nancy Wake, the White Mouse." Mate, you must know the story. Most decorated heroine of the Second World War, one Australian woman leading 7,000 partisan French men in the forest north of Clermont-Ferrand, blowing up the bridges, launching the ambushes, personally leading the attacks on the Germans. Mate, she's 93 years old. She hasn't got long to live. She wants to go back to France to live among the partisans she fought with. She's got no money. Mate, you're a rugby bloke. I'm a rugby bloke. We've got to do the right thing. You've got to write a book. To which I said the obvious, mate, I'm not the Salvation Army. I don't sort of write books on that, but I'd like to meet her. So I flew to Port Macquarie, had this extraordinary 2 hours with this 93-year-old woman who showed to me the bayonet scar from her left wrist down to her left elbow from the German guard she'd killed that was guarding an ammo dump. And I just was so absorbed. It felt like the Second World War had finished about 10 years before, not 50 years before, let alone 60 years before. And I flew, I called my publisher from the phone box at Port Macquarie Airport, said, "Forget the Meninga story and the Alan Border book, I want to do this." And of all the books I've done, that one was the purest in the sense of every other book I do, I want to make money. I'm not going to, for example, here, I'm not going to hijack this occasion and beg you to read my books, hand on my heart, hope to die. I don't care if you do or don't read my books. Don't care. All I care is that you buy my books. And this one, I thought it'll only sell 5,000 or 10,000 copies, but it'll please the spirit of my late parents, both of whom served in the Second World War. And so I'll do it. And it was an extraordinary exercise to be dealing with a 93-year-old woman. And the great lesson that I learnt from it was that while the spirit of the woman that launched the attack on the Germans was 100% intact, the flesh around was fragile, but that spirit was absolutely there. She and I had quite a few blues early on until we both came to the conclusion that she was 10 times the man that I would ever be, which helped settle us both down. Come the day of the great launch, Jewish Museum, Surrey Hills, 300 people there, 50 from the media, back in the days when the media could send out 50 people for something like that. And I asked Lieutenant General Peter Cosgrove, Commander-in-Chief, Australian Defence Forces, to do the honours. He's up on the stage. I'm over on the left. Peter Cosgrove, two ceremonial swords, Vietnam medals, number one uniform, over in the corner, little old lady, now 94 years old, Nancy Wake, with a walking stick, draped across her shoulders for reasons best known to herself. She had a dead fox. Exactly the way my mother used to have a fox stole, but I haven't seen one since 1975. And so Peter Cosgrove gives a great speech. He says, "We've had many great warriors in this country. I don't think, however, pound for pound, we've ever had the equal of this woman. I'm proud to launch her book. I do launch her book. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Nancy Wake." 300 people in an historically significant moment leap to their feet to give her a standing ovation. Absolute wild acclaim. And this was the first time she'd been acclaimed like that in New Zealand, in England, in America, and certainly in France. Never before in Australia. This is huge. And everybody's cheering into the echo. Everybody looks expectantly at Nancy. Is she going to speak? And finally she stands up, totters over to the podium, glares at the 300 people giving her a standing ovation, leans into the microphone. We lean towards her. We don't want to miss a word. Her entire speech, she said, "I've just got one thing to say. I killed a lot of Germans, and I'm only sorry I didn't kill more. Thank you." And that was it. And for me, the extraordinary thing about that was that instead of selling 5,000 or 10,000, it sold 200,000. And that was the first clue that I got that my publishers got, and to a certain extent the Australian publishing industry got, that there was a market for Australian stories told in the Australian vernacular about great Australian people, great Australian events. And so that's pretty much what I've ever been doing ever since, with the odd detour. One of my books that I did was, and I say it particularly to this audience, was The Joys of Growing Up in Regional Australia in the 1960s. So I did a book called A Simpler Time. I was the youngest, and still the youngest of seven children. As I mentioned, Mum and Dad came back from the Second World War and started a farm with 60 acres. Many of you might remember the Golden Fleece Service Station up there and the Oak Milk Bar. We were opposite the... We still are. Golden Fleece Service Station's gone, but we're still there. Mum and Dad are buried there. And so I talked about Mum and Dad. You know, they grew oranges, lemons, tomatoes and children. And the children got bigger as they got younger. I was so long when I was born at 25 and a half inches. Mum said I was born on the 27th, the 28th and the 29th of June, 1961. And they say if you had a happy childhood, you remember the sun shining. If you had an unhappy childhood, you remember wet Wednesday afternoons trudging home from school. And I remember the sun shining, Dad teaching us poetry, playing tennis after working on the farm, going up to Peach Ridge Public. My mother, a wonderful, wonderful woman, was deeply, deeply conservative. She wanted children to remain children as long as they possibly could. She did not acknowledge to us the existence of sex. She didn't acknowledge to us the existence that Santa Claus might be a little bit far-fetched. And this is an absolute true story. At one point, I said to Mum, how did you and Dad do it, the whole Santa Claus thing? You know, with seven children in the house, how did you manage to sort of sort out the presents and get them without waking anyone up? Mum was absolutely appalled at the question and would not acknowledge to me that Santa Claus wasn't real, even though at that point I was already old enough to have been sent from the field for violence against the All Blacks. I was 29 years old, and she still wouldn't do it. And I told the story in the book, that how my deeply conservative mother, right in the final days of her life, there was something that changed, because we'd gathered at the homestead overnight, knowing Mum did not have long, and we're all there, and with 2 days to go, my sisters help her to the bathroom, and she slumped on the loo, and my sister Kathy says to my mum, "Mum, what's the best thing in your life?" And Mum said, "Huh? What's the, looking back, Mum, what's the best thing in your life?" And Mum said, "Sex with your father." And I put that in the book, and my Auntie Mary was absolutely appalled, saying, "My sister never would have said such a thing." But she said exactly that, and as a family, we're very proud of that. In terms of doing war books, I learnt lessons as I went along. The Nancy Wake book was certainly a breakthrough, but the one that sort of turned into Hot August Night in terms of really making a huge impact, and I think it's still 350,000 copies or something, is Kokoda. And what I learnt out of that was the virtues of not focusing on the generals and the politicians, but getting the stories of the men. Who were these blokes that took on the Japanese on the Kokoda track? And I got very close to several of them, none closer than a fellow by the name of Joe Dawson. And he was from Fitzroy in Melbourne. The bombs land on Pearl Harbor on the 7th of December 1941, the day that we'll live in infamy. America declares war, Australia declares war. 3 months later, Joe is at home in Fitzroy, knock on the door, opens it up, and there is the cable boy saying, "Here's the cable." He opens it up. "Dear Private Joe Dawson, 39th Battalion, you've been called up tomorrow night, Flinders Street Station. You turn up with your kit bag. There'll be a train to take you to Sydney, ship to take you to Port Moresby. You know, this is on." And so the following night, there is Joe, holding the love of his life, Elaine. They've been going steady for 2 years. They're both 19 years old. And if the war hadn't come, they'd probably already be married. And the sergeant major says, "Company, fall in." They've got to extricate from each other, swearing their undying love. And Joe gets on the plane, opens the window to kiss Elaine for the last time for a while. She hands to him a package and says, "Remember this, wear this and think of me." And he slumps back, he kisses her, puts his little head out the window. The whistle blows, the train pulls away, and that jerky motion that trains are wont to do. He watches her get smaller and smaller until she disappears as the train goes around the corner. He opens the package and out comes a silver watch. And on the back of the watch it says, "To Joe, for all time, love, Elaine." He puts it on, he immediately feels stronger because whatever else he's going to face, he knows that he has the love of a good woman. They get to Sydney, Central Station, march down Elizabeth, right on William, left on Crown, down to the Finger Wharf, and get on the troop ship, the Aquitania, designed to hold 3,000, on this day holding 6,000. Joe said it was so heavily overladen that when he goes down below and to put his kit on the bunk, he looks out the porthole window and there's a big fish looking back at him. They get to Port Moresby. The Japanese have landed at Gona on the north shore of New Guinea. 13,000 seriously well-trained Japanese soldiers come down the Kokoda track heading for Port Moresby. And if they get to Port Moresby and they take Port Moresby, the Japanese will then have a port close to Australia for the possible invasion of Australia. It's serious to try to stop them. All we in Australia have got to stop them in the first instance is 400 men of C Company of the 39th Battalion, including Private Joe Dawson. They march up, they meet in the Battle of Ishirava, and it goes for 72 hours, and their job is to hold them up until the other battalions can join them, which they do. And about 70 hours in, this shell from a Japanese mountain gun lands, gets near them, explodes, and Joe's blown back into the jungle. He comes to about 3 minutes later, and he did what they all did. Have I got a left leg? There's a good start. Right leg, good. I've got right arm, torso's dry, I haven't got a death shot there, my noggin's still there, left. The silver watch. He cannot find the silver watch. And by the light of the shells exploding, he scrabbles around on the jungle floor, still can't find it. They drag him away, put him back together. And he does the next 3 years of the war, nearly dies by his count on 10 occasions from shrapnel, from bullets, from malaria. He lives. Come through the heads of Sydney Harbour, 28th of October 1945, pull into the Finger Wharf, bottom of the gangplank is Elaine. She's waiting for him. They marry within 48 hours. They live happily ever after up in Foster on the New South Wales North Coast. My book comes out 2003. Bob Carr, in June of 2003, the Premier, launches it down in Woolloomooloo in a pub there. Joe's in the front row, first time he'd ever been with somebody that voted Labor in his life, let alone the Labor Premier. And the book goes well immediately. 6 weeks later, Joe is there in his home in Foster. The phone rings and he picks it up and it's the gravelly voice of a very old man. He says, "Your name, Joe Dawson?" Joe says, "Yeah." He says, "You're the Joe Dawson in Fitzsimons' book on Kokoda." Joe says, "Yeah." He said, "My name's Bill Carruthers. I fought with the 2nd 44th Battalion, Battle of Ishirava, and I found a watch." 2 days later, ding dong, Elaine, his wife then of 62 years, opens the door. There is a little bloke from DHL. She signs for it, opens it up, with the scissors, out comes the silver watch, looks on the back, "To Joe, for all time, love, Elaine." And he'd just come back from abdominal surgery at the hospital. He wasn't feeling strong, but he put it on. He felt immediately stronger for the fact that whatever else, he had the love of a good woman. And so those kind of stories are the ones that I look for to bring it to life, to not just, we have, I say this particularly for a literary audience, if I say fiction and non-fiction, the image of fiction is flights of fancy, Dickens, wonderful, but little Dorrit, Great Expectations. And yet when you're reading Great Expectations, I put it to you, there's a little voice which whispers to you, "This didn't happen. There was no Miss Havisham. There was no wedding cake. There was no Pip. There was no Estella. This came out of the fertile genius brain of Charles Dickens, but it never actually happened." So what I have strained to do, and the image of non-fiction nevertheless, is not a good one, because the image of non-fiction is, on the 23rd of October, they landed on the North Shore and they marched inland and they had 375 men and they had 25 pounds of food. Who cares? What I've wanted to do, what I've learnt to do, I guess, is to use the devices of fiction and apply them to non-fiction so that it feels like a novel. The story develops a narrative like a novel We get to know more about the characters. There's twists and turns in the road. But instead of the little voice that says, this didn't happen, you get a big voice to say, this actually happened. This is extraordinary. And so for you to judge whether or not I've pulled it off, but that is what I'm trying to do, mixed with what I call SSS, sights, sounds and smells, to research it so well with my researchers that you can build up a scene and recreate a life and times to know what it was actually like. So when I started out, like doing Nancy Wake, I wanted to be the master narrator by the campfire to say, you know, lean in close, it was a dark and stormy night, and everybody goes, this is a good story. What I now want, no campfire, no me, I just want, it is a dark and stormy night. The flash of the lightning, the thunder reveals an extraordinary scene taking place on the outskirts of Amiens. That kind of stuff where it's all researched, it's all happening, and yet you know that it's real. And so an example, I guess, of one of the best stories, the best story I've ever done, the best book, the best pure yarn, is The Shipwreck of the Batavia. There will never be a better story than what happened there on 5th of June 1629, when this Dutch ship with 333 souls hit the Abrolhos archipelago 36 miles west of what is now Geraldton, and basically it turned into Nightmare on Elm Street meets Lord of the Flies. And the extraordinary story of the guys that go for help when they come back, the climax of that story, Spielberg would reject it as just too impossible, too improbable. Nobody could believe that that would happen, and it did. But the second best story in the history of the world is the one of the Catalpa rescue, another story from WA, and it's these weird WA people. They generate the best stories in the world, but at the age of five, they all take a pinky promise with each other, and they say, don't tell any bastard that lives east of Kalgoorlie. Just keep it to us. But the story of the Catalpa rescue, just quickly, to set up for Jacka and the rest of it, is, as you know, for the Brits had occupied Ireland for about 700 years. And for about 700 years, the Irish were deeply unhappy about it. And the plan was, how are we going to get rid of them? We'll have a rising, we'll be joined by peasants with pikes in the moonlight, and we'll stick them. And for 700 years, the Brits, volley one, volley two, volley three, blow them all away. Until in 1848, the Troubles took a different hue. They were starving, and in County Clare, a 12-year-old boy dies of starvation in the arms of his 15-year-old brother, John Devoy, who swears vengeance, swears to devote his entire life to getting the Brits out of Ireland. And so he goes away and joins the French Foreign Legion. He learns weaponry, he learns bombing, he learns intelligence, counterintelligence, tactics, strategy. He comes back to Ireland and says, here's the new plan. We've got 5,000 English officers running 50,000 Irish soldiers occupying our land. We need to get to those Irish soldiers. So next time there's a rising, instead of peasants with pikes in the moonlight, we'll have platoons, we'll have companies, we'll have battalions on our sides, we'll blow the bridges, we'll kill the Brits, we'll win the day. They were called the Fenians. And so in each platoon, I'm a Fenian, you're a Fenian, we meet for training, we know what to do. The conspiracy spreads until it's discovered. 62 of them are arrested, put on trial for treason, and sent away to the most remote prison on earth, which is Fremantle Prison in just outside of Perth. And you can imagine what that's like. 62 of them in their chains, coming out of the bowels of an English prison ship and looking up, blinding light, the first time they've seen it in 6 months, there on the hill is this white, monolithic Fremantle prison, and they drag their chains up there. Meantime, John Devoy is not sent to Fremantle. He's been arrested, he's been on trial, but because he's not a soldier, he can't be put on trial for treason. He's sent away before he goes up in his chains up into the bowels of his own English prison ship, bound for an English prison. He says to the love of his life, sweet Eliza Kenny, I will always love you. I don't know how long I'll be in prison for, if it's 5 years or 50 years, but if you are not married, when I get out, I will come and I will marry you. I will find you because I love you. You're the love of my life. He goes to the prison, and after 5 years, 300,000 Irish have signed a petition about John Devoy. pleading for amnesty. Basically, it'll affect trade between Ireland and England. The Brits say, all right, we will let him out so long as he never goes back to Ireland. They send him to America, where he becomes a successful journalist, then editor, then publisher. And after 10 years of prosperity, he comes back through his office at that New York Herald Tribune in Fifth Avenue after lunch one day, and there on the desk is this scungy, horrible letter. And he opens it up, and the letter says, we're dying. We are in the living tomb. Worms are eating our souls. You got us in here to this prison. You've got to get us out. There are 6 Fenians left in prison. They've smuggled this letter out to the man that got them there in the first place. And Devoy realises they are right. He immediately takes leave of the newspaper, goes up and down the eastern seaboard, talks to 7,000 Irish Americans, raises $30,000, says, I can't tell you what I want the money for. All you need to know is we're going to strike a blow against England. $30,000, he goes to New Bedford, Massachusetts. He buys the fastest whaler they've got. He says, who is your best whaling captain? They said, well, that'll be Captain Swashbuckle up on the hill. He's 32 years old. He married with a child last year. His wife has told him he can't go to sea no more. He can't go to sea no more. He's very unhappy about it, but go and talk to him. So he goes to talk to Captain Swashbuckle, who says, why should I help you? And the answer is, well, one thing is, well, I'm going to give you $1,000 if you can pull it off. The second thing is, I'm George Washington. You Americans, you revere George Washington because he guided you to get England, Britain out of America. That's what I'm trying to do for Ireland after 700 years. So Captain Swashbuckle signs on, hires 18 sailors. They sail away to Fremantle. It'll take them a year to get there. Meantime, however, Devoy sends 2 emissaries across the United States to catch a steamer from San Francisco to Sydney, round to Albany. They arrive in Fremantle 3 months before the Catalpa, and they disguise themselves as Irish investors and in gold mines and sheep stations. So we might be needing some labour. Would you like to look at Fremantle Prison up on the hill to see if some of those might want to do labouring for you? We can hire them out to you. Yes, we would. And these are our famous Fenians, 6 of them left. And the Irish investors are able to say, we're here, we're going to break you out. And they fire Irish guards. They pass by a conduit the plans. Easter Monday, 1874, you've got to be by 9 o'clock in the morning at the piggery next to the gum tree, and there'll be 2 buggies waiting for you. That morning, boss, they're out on work detail. Boss, I've got to get some more kerosene. Boss, I need some more paint. Boss, I've got to go and move furniture at the governor's house. They get to the gum tree. There is 2 buggies. They jump in and immediately they race away to Rockingham Beach. There, waiting for them on the beach, is Captain Swashbuckle with 6 sailors in a longboat. They jump in, they pull through the waves. As they're pulling through the waves, 3 troopers come down, Kelly Davis and Fitzroy, with 2 Indigenous black trackers, and they pull out there and they start firing, and in the boat they keep pulling away. And every brilliant story, as we know, needs a dark and stormy night. This night, dark and stormy like they'd never seen it before. The wind howled, the waves crashed. They get to dawn more dead than alive, like drowned rats. They still can't see the sails of the Catalpa. They keep pulling out to sea at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They see it, the sails in the distance. They pull towards it, but they also see the smoke rising from the Coast Guard of the Fremantle Coast Guard. There's a race between the two to get to the Catalpa first. The goodies win. They jump on the ship. The Coast Guard pulls alongside, lines up the cannon straight at the midships of the Catalpa, and the captain of the Coast Guard yells out, we've got you dead to rights, pull over, driver. You've got 6 prisoners trying to escape, or pull over or we'll blow you out of the water. Captain Swashbuckle gets the American flag out, pulls it up the yardarm and calls back, we are a ship sailing under the flag of the United States of America in international waters. You have no jurisdiction of us. If you fire a single shot upon this ship, a state of war will exist between the United States of America and the pissant colony of Western Australia. Captain Coast Guard says, wait right there. I am going back to Fremantle for further instructions. They sail away. The catalpa sails away, and 6 months later, they're coming up the Hudson at this point with the six liberated prisoners. At this point, New York, one in five New Yorkers was Irish-American. This was the first victory over England in 700 years. They put each prisoner in an open carriage, took them up Fifth Avenue. 300,000 New Yorkers turned out, cheer them to the echo. They all, seriously, go on to live happily ever after. 1923, Ireland has been liberated for 3 years, its own people, they got rid of the Brits, they're running their own show. And there's an old man on a ship 60 miles off the coast of Ireland, bound for County Cork, eating his porridge. And the cable boy brings for him a cable, he opens it up and the cable says, "Dear John Devoy, this is President Boothby of the People's Republic of Ireland. We know who you are. We know you have devoted your entire life to the liberation of Ireland. When you get here, we want you to regard yourself as the guest of the People's Republic of Ireland, because we want to honour you and what you've done." Devoy sends a note back to say, "Dear President Boothby, thank you, I am honoured, but I'm just visiting Ireland for the first time in 62 years. I don't want any fuss." Ireland doesn't care. When the ship comes in to the same wharf that he had left 62 years earlier in chains, there, as he comes down the gangplank, are 60 gleaming Irish soldiers. "Company, present arms, click, 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 salute now." And he walks between this honour guard, gets into a carriage, takes him away to Dublin, to the station, which takes him to Dublin. For 6 days and six nights, he's feted as never before. The liberator of Ireland, John Devoy, has arrived. The following Tuesday, things are calming down a little, and he's having his porridge at his niece's house. The whistle blows, and he has this moments of melancholy where he thinks, "This is good. Ireland is liberated, as I've devoted my entire life. I've avenged the death of my brother. And it's as good as I could possibly imagine. But I'm 86 years old, not long to live. I've never loved another woman like I loved sweet Eliza Kenny. I'm all alone. She didn't wait for me. She married another, died in 1904, and I'm all alone." Whistle outside. It's the mailman's just arrived. The niece brings inside the letter from, and it's just arrived. He looks at it. He recognises the writing. It is the handwriting of sweet Eliza Kenny. She's alive. She hadn't died in 1904. That was her sister. She hadn't married another. She'd waited for him for 17 fucking years and finally been reduced to marrying a dentist. That's how bad it got. And she lives 3 miles away. So he gets in the carriage, and this time not, it's more, takes some time, gets there half an hour later, climbs the stairs, and with his withered 86-year-old hand, knocks on her door. It takes some time for her withered 86-year-old legs to come down the hall to open the door, but she opens, they fall into each other's arms for the first time in 62 years, declare their undying love. And then we get to the best part of the story of the lot, the twist and turn that nobody could see coming, that Spielberg himself wouldn't believe. Absolutely extraordinary. And you'll find it on page 217 of my book. In terms of the First World War books that I've done, so the big books I saw were Coda and Tobruk, Second World War, and I sort of left First World War because I was foggy about it. I didn't really know much about it. But the more I got into that First World War stuff, it was horrifying. What was done there, and just staggering. And the most angry I get, there was a brilliant piece written about this in the Herald, Anzac Day this year. Matter of fact, I wrote it. And the theme of my piece was, in Australia, we have many emotions that course through our veins every Anzac Day, led by remembrance, respect, and reverence. And I said in this piece, there's an R we're missing. And that is rage. We haven't yet indulged in rage because we sent away 333,000, 62,000 were killed, 47,000 are still in France. And when we know the circumstances of the death of some of them whose names are on the honour rolls, we need to feel rage. If you get to the Battle of Fromelles, these are your grandfathers, great uncles and all the rest. And they were ordered to charge 400 metres across swampy ground in broad daylight straight at a German bunker which was bristling with German machine guns that could fire 600 bullets a minute in this cruel lattice work of death. And when the great German, when the great Australian general from Melbourne, Pompey Elliott, first saw these orders, he grabbed the English major that had come up with a plan, Major Howard, and said, "What do you think will happen to my men if I give them these orders?" And Howard said, I don't like to talk like this. He said, "I'm asking you, what do you think will happen?" He said, "Well, if you're asking me, I think it'll be a bloody Holocaust." Pompey Elliott said, "Well, get those orders changed." They weren't changed. And so there they were, our blokes, 7,000 ready to go. The whistle blows. They charge straight at the German machine guns. They are cut to pieces in the next 14 hours. Of the 7,000 Australians that went forward, 5,500 went down. 1,850 of them were killed. Absolutely insane. And yet we've never been in Australia able to indulge in that rage because we want to believe that their deaths counted for something more than needless slaughter. And it was because of things like that that the idea started to take hold among Australian troops and finally Australian politicians. Seeing as we're Australians fighting for the Australian Army on behalf of Australia, do you think maybe we could have an Australian in charge? And there was an outcry, particularly in England, but also in Australia, an absolute outcry. We can't have Australians in charge of Australians. There's got to be the English. There's got to be English in charge of the Australians. And it will amaze you, but it's true. There are still people in Australia that have that same attitude today when it comes to our constitutional government. There are people who think there's a Pommy family in England that is much better suited than any of ours to run the show because we Australians, we're just not good enough to do it ourselves. We need to have the English royal family. On this occasion, however, John Monash, the great general, Sir John Monash took over as Australian leader of the Australian troops, and for the first time, instead of being sent to their needless slaughter, he analysed it like an engineer would. He got the tanks to do the heavy lifting. And instead of losing 1,850 men in his first battle, he only lost 300 men. Instead of going 50 yards, they went 1.5 miles. It was genius. And that was where Albert Jacka, who I've written about, came in, because Jacka was typical of that generation, more anonymous than a lost dog. When he left Australia, he was a timber cutter from Victoria, from the Dandenongs. And he, nobody knew anything about him, but he was one of those blokes that as soon as the battle started, he was terrific. And so on the shores of Gallipoli, he landed very shortly after the battle had begun. And instead of doing, I think a lot of us wonder how we would go under bullets whistling past our ear and shrapnel. I don't know. I've played a lot of football. I'm keenly aware that whatever plaudits I got for courage in football, it's 1 in 1,000 of the plaudits deserved for soldiers that actually do this with bullets whistling. And I have half a suspicion I'd be the one weeping at the bottom of the trench. Jacka was not like that. Jacka was calm, he was considered, he knew what to do, he knew how to do it, he became a leader of men. And on the 19th of May, on the afternoon, the Turks basically went double or nothing, we're going to blow the Australians away. And they lined up 40,000 Turks just to charge in wave after wave after this shell fire to soften them up. In the early hours of the 20th of May 1915, the Turks broke through. They got into a trench. Albert Jacka was right there. He took command. He organised two of the soldiers with him. Here's the grenades. I want you to lob it over into their trench. 30 seconds after I hop over the top, I'm going to come at them from an angle they don't expect. And got it, good, go. And so he jumps over, he crouches. the first grenade misses the trench where the Turks are in. The second one lands. Jacka is upon the Turks half a second later with the bayonet. Everything, there's cries, but everything then goes quiet. And 15 minutes later, a lieutenant puts his head round the corner and sees Jacka leaned up against the seven Turks that he's killed with a cigarette and says, "Well, I got the buggers, sir." And Australia lost its nut, because this was proof positive that our soldiers were every bit as good as the English soldiers, if not better. He became the most famous man in Australia. When the Australians were evacuated, they get back to Cairo. Jacka has witnessed close up the insanity of so many of these orders. They say that generals always fight the last war, that they learn the lessons in the Boer War that they apply to the First World War. They learn the lessons in the First World War and they apply to the Second World War, but they're always a war behind. Jacka was not like that. Jacka was on the spot. He realised the insanity of it all, and so he applied to join the officers' training school in Cairo. The Brits said, "No, we're looking for officers and gentlemen. You're not a gentleman. You left school at 13 years old." And it was John Monash who intervened and said, "That may be the way you Brits do it. It's not the way we do it. We Australians will give it on merit. This man will make an outstanding officer," and so he was. And so we get to the Battle of Pozieres when they get to the Western Front. Again, how lucky we are in this room, as far as I know, none of us to have faced bullets whistling, some of you may be returned service people, how lucky most of us are never to have faced, well, none of us have faced what they faced there. Can you imagine the horror of marching towards Pozieres? As we go forward, we see the 1st Division, the Australian 1st Division, coming back, and we'd seen them go up, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, clear of eye, and we see them come back 5 days later, completely shattered, and men are missing arms, missing legs, being carried on stretchers, men crying out, and we're going, this is where next, we're next going into this meshing machine. And then as we get close to Pozieres, it's starting to get dark, and that rumbling, what is that rumbling? Oh, Christ, that's not rumbling of thunder, that is artillery. What's that ebbing, that pulsing light on the horizon? What is that? Is that lightning? No, that's the shell fire exploding that we're marching into. As we get closer still, and there are more and more men coming back missing legs and arms and blood, we notice that the ground beneath our feet is spongy. Why is it spongy? Because we're walking on the bodies of dead men that died 3 months ago, 3 weeks ago, 3 hours ago. And our job is to hold this, with this platoon, is to hold this section of trench with Albert Jacka VC. And we get to the trench, 30 of us, and through the night, the shells keep landing. Those that are direct hits wipe out our mates. Those that miss make the trenches collapse, and we have to dig out our mates to get to dawn. We get to dawn, and there's only 7 of us left with Jacka, still alive. Jacka pokes his head up, realises that 50 Germans have broken through, armed Germans, and have captured 80 Australian prisoners and are coming back this way. Jacka gives the orders, "Fix bayonets, we're going to charge." Me, I would have said, "Fix what? Charge who? What? We're 7 of us. You want us to charge 50 armed Germans?" But it was Albert Jacka VC. He was a leader of men. They fixed bayonets and they charged. Jacka in the lead. They get to grips. The 80 Australian prisoners who have been led back get involved in this murderous melee. It goes for 20 minutes. By the time it's over, the Germans have thrown down their weapons. The Australians have won their day. And Jacka is the hero, but he's barely alive. He's got 7 wounds from his body, losing blood. His brother was there, looked down upon him, and there's a bit of footage from 1978, and he says, "I looked down and I thought, well, Albert, I'll never see you again." But Albert survived, and he gets to Britain, he gets patched up. He's basically got shell shock, what we'd call shell shock or post-traumatic stress, but he insists on going back to Western Front. He feels that once he gets back into situation normal with bullets and bayonets and all the rest, he'll be okay. And he was right. The Battle of Bullecourt, he is magnificent. By this point, he's an intelligence officer. And he realises the tanks are going to be disaster and the Battle of Bullecourt will be more slaughter. And he's the one that blows the whistle and says, "Call it off." They don't call it off. It was a disaster. Jacka, with great fortitude, writes the report on the tanks to say, basically, "Listen, you bastards, if you're going to use tanks, this is the way you've got to use them. They've got to arrive in strength, on time. They've got to attack the one point. They can't be dispersed. And, crucially, The tank commanders have to be following the orders of the infantry commander, not the other way around. And this makes its way to Monash, and Monash, as I mentioned, on the 4th of July, launches this extraordinary battle, the Battle of Le Hamel, which I know well because I wrote the book Monash's Masterpiece, and the whole war changes. Jacka comes back to Australia. As I mentioned, he'd left anonymous, an anonymous man. When he gets back to Melbourne, 200,000 Melburnians are waiting for him to cheer him to the echo. Alas, he was not well. His war had finished with a lung full of mustard gas. And he struggled through the 1920s, and by the end of the 20s, he was the mayor of St Kilda, and he devoted the resources of the mayoralty, the shire, to supporting veterans and putting food on the table of the unemployed, giving them work. When he died on the 19th of January 1932, the funeral, they turned out in their tens of thousands, and his coffin was borne to his grave at St Kilda Cemetery by 8 awardees of the VC. An extraordinary testament to the man. And the most wonderful thing is that for the next 62 years after he died, the survivors of his battalion, that didn't call themselves the 14th Battalion, they called themselves Jacka's Mob. Those survivors would gather at his graveside on the anniversary of his death. And it went until the late 80s, early 90s. They were still attending until there were none there anymore. So for me to write that book, I've loved doing that book. I felt it's an honour and a privilege to try to bring to life these lost stories. And, you know, when I was a young journalist at the Herald, there was a writer called Padraic P. McGuinness. And I said to him, why are you sort of in the Herald every day? You know, every day there's something in the op-ed. And he said, son, so many stories to write, so many columns to write, so little time, which I thought distinctly odd at the time as I went out for a long lunch. But now I get it. I feel like for me, there are so many more books that I want to write, stories I want to tell. And so it's been an honour and a privilege. The thing that I've realised after many years of telling stories in the public domain, when I find myself starting to ramble, I like to do what the Americans did in Vietnam. I declare victory and leave. Thank you for your attention. I welcome any questions you might have. Thank you. Thank you.
A huge thank you to Peter Fitzsimons for sharing such an interesting author talk with our audience. SMSA members can borrow The Legend of Albert Jacka from our library on level 2. You can also purchase a copy from your local bookstore. We've provided a link to our friends at Abby's Bookshop in the description below. Thanks for listening and have a wonderful day.